Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Women Emerging podcast. I'm Julian Middleton, founder of Women Emerging and your podcast host. Every Wednesday, I explore how women lead differently. Over time, all of us who are part of Women Emerging are determined to redefine leading so that more of us can say, if that's leading, I'm in. First, we had a human rights lawyer, and then we had the editor of a newspaper talking about how to lead in hostile environments. This week, we're going in a completely different direction. Still hostile environments, but a very different hostile environment, because Jill is a diver in deep sea caves. Jill knows about physical fear, and I just wanted to talk to her about how to cope with a hostile environment. Now, you don't have to be a cave diver to find this a fascinating episode, because everything she says, I think, translates into our own everyday lives in, let's face it, often hostile environments. Jill, you're a cave diver. What does that mean?
Yes, that's a very abstract concept for most people, but I'm literally swimming through tunnels that are filled with water beneath your feet. So I'm going to places where nobody has ever gone before.
And caving, is it a world of women doing it or men doing it? Oh. Is it mostly men doing it?
Yeah. Most of my life's activities, my career, everything seems to be in more male-dominated spaces. So yes, caving, adventure, underwater photography, all of those things are dominated by men. But the sort of legion of women coming up through the ranks is growing, and that gives me hope.
And I suppose when you're down under the water, it's pretty irrelevant where you are on the spectrum.
You know, I think that's one of the things that I love about being a diver and being in the underwater world is that, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, what your cultural background, your finances, your gender, your appearance, anything like that. As soon as you're submerged beneath the surface, the sounds of the outdoor world or the above, you know, water world are gone. And we all just float freely and equally in this beautiful space. We can all swim like mermaids.
My first question to you, I suspect, is, I'm sure a lot of it's swimming like mermaids, but there must have been some really, really frightening moments. Tell me what fear feels like.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple types of fear. There's like the fear before something has happened, and that might be just this sick feeling in your stomach or this, you know, sense of impending doom. But it kind of grows and gets worse, that knot in your stomach or I call them chattering monkeys that are running around inside your head. But when something startles you and the fear really kicks in, then your respirations go up, your heart races. And again, there's that explosion of thoughts all happening at once inside your head and dread.
Tell me about dread.
Yeah, I mean, the dread creeps in, like something bad is going to happen. You know, something is out of my control. Like fear has all of those aspects to it.
Whether you're under the water or above the water and frightened.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No matter what you're doing. I mean, for some people, there might be a lot of fear just associated with, you know, giving an idea to their boss at work. For others, you know, it might be fear of getting on a roller coaster. Oh, this is going to be scary. For me, fear is definitely associated with, you know, what can be existential threats. I mean, I could lose my life anytime I go into a cave in an underwater environment. It's an incredibly dangerous pursuit.
And when your heart starts racing, what happens then?
Well, I think when your heart starts racing and you're breathing fast, then there's a chance that things can kind of get out of control. Like for me, I learned to sort of breathe away the fear and bring myself down from that precipice. But if you don't, it's just an ultimate destination, and that's panic. And I can't afford to panic in an environment underwater when, you know, there's a finite amount of gas for me to breathe to keep myself alive before I reach the doorway to safety.
So there's a line that goes from fear to panic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Describe that one.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think, as you kind of stand on that precipice and you feel, you know, that breathing, I mean, I think we've all been there where, you know, you're crying uncontrollably, you're breathing fast, and you just can't feel like you can't get a gulp of air. You know, that's where you're just, you know, standing on the edge of panic. And when panic sets in, then it's almost as if you have no control over your thoughts and your actions anymore. And so for me, I have to reel it in long before that. I have to regain control of my breathing. And I think that's the key to everything. I take this huge, deep breath, like right down into my hips, all the way up through my lungs, even up into my neck, gathering in as much air as I can, and I hold it, and then I just slowly let it out. And as I let it out, I tell myself to let go of the emotions too, and to center myself in a more pragmatic brain to move forward.
When I feel that kind of fear, and it's never below water, one of the things that always goes through my mind too is, because I'm never at fear of death, so obviously it's different, mm-hmm. but it's a sense of, this fear is going to make me better at doing what I'm about to try to do. And it's sort of trying to reframe fear as a friend.
Oh, no question, fear is a friend. If I had a nickel for every journalist that wrote a story about me and the headline said fearless, I'd be a rich woman. But I am not fearless, not at all. I am afraid every time I go diving, and people go, what? But I want to dive with people that are also afraid, because it means that we both have respect for the risks that we're about to take. And if those, you know, fears are understood, the risks are understood, then we have a chance to mitigate them, solve our issues even before we go under the water. But it's just an understanding with my partner that we both want to come home safely at the end of the day. We both want to come home to our partners. And people who are fearless, who say, yeah, I got this, let's do it, you know, I don't really want to dive with them because I feel like they don't have the respect for what we're about to do.
And that goes down. I remember you saying that you have to, never close down other people's fears.
Yeah, no question. You know, when you put together a team of people of varying levels of experience, some will have sort of faced this journey already. Others will be very new. And when somebody's helping you as a support diver, a safety person or whatever, when they're helping you on a project, they feel a tremendous amount of pressure to make your projects a success. They feel like they can't have an issue because they're there to be your support. They're there to be your safety. Or they're, you know, enamored with you as a leader. They're like, oh, wow, I want to be her when I grow up, that kind of thing. And so we often don't give those people permission for fear or permission to fail. But it's incredibly important to tell the newest person on the job, the person with the least amount of skills and experience, that you want their voice to be heard. There are dives where I've had to take an entire day to prepare my equipment, and I've needed a half a dozen people to help me get dressed in the water and to help me go through my safety checks and protocols. And I need to know that that person who just showed up today to be a safety support person is going to speak up if there's some hose sticking out of the back of my gear that's not connected that I can't see. Because there are a lot of people who are too afraid, there's that fear word again, to say something. But I want them to have responsibility in their work, but I also want to give them authority. And there's a difference between those two things. The authority is really important. And there are many leaders that quiet everyone beneath them and say, no, I got this. I've got the experience. But the truth is that we are only as good as the sum of everybody participating in a project. And those junior voices are incredibly important.
What do you do, I mean really do, to empower those voices? Do you go out and party with them? Do you hold their hands? Do you sit down next to them? Do you look at them with different eyes? What are the really practical things you do to send a message to everybody that their voice counts?
First of all, I try to remember what it was like for me when I was that person, and try to approach them in that mindset. And, you know, as long as the size of the project is allowable, and it almost always is for me, I want to spend personal time with someone, look them in the eyes and tell them that I value their opinion, tell them that I'm counting on their opinion, that I want them to speak. So very clearly empower them. And then on many projects, I like to give people different roles, roles that they don't think they're ready for. So I've had people call me up and say, I need you to mentor me, to help me, you know, with the science plans for this project. And I may start by saying, okay, well, I think maybe this, and this. And then I'll say, you know what? You really don't need me. You can do this. And most of the time it's like, no, I'm not ready for that. I'm like, yeah, you are. I mean, we've just ensured that you know what needs to be done and you can do this. You don't need me. So making yourself replaceable and making everyone understand that you want them to replace you, I think can really help open the doors for communication.
Have you never, ever been grumpy and irritable and actually undone all that messaging you've just talked about with some silly comment?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think I've definitely grown in my ability to communicate and become wiser and more empathetic to what someone feels like. And it's based on my life experiences, for sure. Like, I remember what I felt like when someone said X, Y, Z to me. I don't think I've ever taken away someone's power with a comment or an action of mine. I think as I look in the past, I know that I could have been more clear and better use the capabilities of those you know, younger, newer people on my team. And I'm much better about that now. And I'm also, you know, I'm not fussed about being replaced. Like, as I look at young people doing amazing diving things today or images or whatever, that actually inspires me. I don't feel like, oh my gosh, you know, my job is in trouble now. Because I think that we're all unique. We have unique capabilities and creativities to bring to projects. And so I'm happy to see others succeed too.
One of the things you also said to me is that you have the adventure, let me say this right, the adventurer gene in you. Have I got to, do I say it right? Adventurer gene in you.
Gene.
The trouble
That's
about
a mouthful,
having,
isn't it?
Yeah, I can't say it. The trouble about sometimes having a particular sort of extreme gene in yourself is that you actually begin to think that everybody has it too.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes you not quite good at leading, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I learned, you know, later in life that there's an actual genetic makeup for people like me. It's a DRD47R allele, which is also known as just the 7R gene or the adventure seekers gene. And it represents people that are novelty seekers, sensation seekers, not in a negative sense. We're the curious. We are the hunter-gatherers in history that would have, you know, left the home and gone and, you know, caught the week's worth of meat and brought it back to the family. But that's only 15 to 30% of the population. The rest of the population is a lot more comfortable maintaining the homestead. And, you know, not that they're not adventurous, but they prefer a much more well-defined set of rules and progress. They have expectations where, you know, my life is much more organic and freeform. And that can make the people that don't have the 7R gene uncomfortable, that uncertainty. They need guardrails to operate within. And I have to recognize that not everybody is this free form, let's switch, let's change, you know. I value brainstorming and I value people's opinions and I value a sort of nimble framework that allows us to shift gears for safety or for effectiveness or success. That has to be framed very carefully for the other people. They want to know precisely what I expect from them and what they should do. And so I do need to give them that rule book with a caveat that I will tell them that I may not have foreseen all the things that could happen today. And I do need you to be open-minded and nimble too.
I don't know what gene I have inside myself, but I can hear you and understand that big time. I'm not sure that I am as good as I would like to be at actually producing that structure for other people. Mm-hmm. How have you got good at that?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's really just come through experience. Like people often will arrive on a project and they want to know, like, when are we eating lunch? What are we doing next? What's going to happen? What are you going to see down there? And they have a million questions. And if I want to be effective on a project with limited time and limited budgets, then we need to very quickly get to the point where someone knows exactly what I need them to do, exactly what their role is in a project. So clear communications are incredibly important. But, you know, you also have to give people that time, too, and that comfort, because someone that's asking what's next, when are we eating lunch, you know, when are we getting in the water, that kind of thing, that, you know, really represents anxiety, uncertainty. And so it needs to be addressed for them to be most effective.
And you never get, like I do, sort of irritable of, oh, leave me alone, don't ask me all these details.
Well, there are times when I do need a minute. So if I'm in the middle of, you know, checking my life support equipment for a big dive and people start interrupting. I mean, that's why we have checklists, so that it's not in my memory. It's on a piece of paper. But I will turn to someone and I'll say, you know, I need about 10 minutes to handle this. This is a critical safety point for me. So if you could just give me 10 minutes apiece, that's important. And I'll try and set that up even before I begin the task, as opposed to reacting to someone coming up to me. Like, you know, just give me this moment to do my work.
Yeah. Wow. Wait a minute, you mentioned a charter for communications. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So on some projects, I'll, you know, arrive at the beginning of a project and maybe I know everybody from online, but we've never met in person. We've never worked together. And so I don't know how these people think yet. I don't know what they're going to be like under pressure. And so sometimes we begin with some team building activities. You know, what are your hopes and fears for this project? You know, what are the things that are weighing heavily on your soul? And then, you know, we work towards developing what I call a charter of communications, which is, you know, all right, I'm the project leader, but here's what I expect from you. I expect you to communicate and tell me if I've got a hose that's not plugged into my life support system. And so we actually write down these things, like what are important to you in communications, you know, being polite, being empathetic. And we literally brainstorm and write a list. And then from that list of qualities, we might make, you know, 10 points about what's critically important to us as a team in terms of communication. And it might be that, you know, my voice is heard, recognized, and valued in the field. Or it might be that I want to take on different roles. Like, I want to be the safety person, the communication person, or whatever person today. And so if you have a list that you can then refer to, if someone's not honoring that code of communication, if someone's silencing another's voice because, you know, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, then the entire group can say, hey, oh, well, wait a minute. That's not cool. You know, we said we weren't going to do this. We said we were going to value each other's opinions. So if you could just stop for a moment and let's listen to this person and see, you know, why she thinks what she thinks. Yeah.
So the process for finding the charter is first you find the qualities.
Mm-hmm.
First you identify the qualities. And then you make the list. So what's the difference between the qualities and what's on the list?
Oh, the qualities might just be, you know, empathetic, open-minded, those kinds of things. Like what's important to you in communication. And then we just kind of roll them all together into a little list of sort of actionable items that help us in situations. Because the most common situation I see is that someone with experience says, you know, quiets another voice by just saying, you don't know what you're talking about. But that's not helpful. Like, you don't know what you're talking about is just a very declarative, you know, useless statement. But if the statement was, well, thanks for that consideration, but in my experience, when we've dived in these sorts of conditions, this is what we've run up against. And therefore, I see this as the greatest risk. So you have to help that person who's not communicating effectively to do so in a more positive, nurturing way that informs another less experienced person about why you have an opinion like you do.
But in that, you also say, I'm still interested if I'm wrong.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. A good leader has to be able to say, you know, you might be right. It's incredibly important. Quality and characteristic. And I think that once you have exhibited that to a team, then the bond grows. When you say, you know what, I like your idea, let's do that. You've really empowered and lifted somebody up. You've made your project better. That reflects on you too. It's all good.
Yeah, it's all investing for the future, isn't it? In some ways, it's using the quiet times to prepare for the tough times.
Yeah. Yeah. And learning to set your ego aside. Yeah.
Are there many cave divers who have big egos?
Oh, yes. And it's not solely a male problem, but I would say it's maybe concentrated in the masculine gender. Yeah.
So everything you're saying now feels like it's natural, it's obvious, but clearly it isn't.
No, it's learned. It's learned through the hard work of experience, but frankly, it's also learned through accident analysis and seeing instances when that social hierarchy of communication broke down and caused an accident or an incident. You know, over and over again, we review the mistakes that have caused people their lives and try and figure out not just, you know, maybe what they did wrong with their equipment or maybe just not a health issue, but we try and look at those other things that happened. Like, was there a failure of, you know, their human machine interface? Was there, you know, a failure of their ability to communicate with others in the team? Was there a failure to heed warnings that were obvious? Was there a failure to, you know, stick to the safety protocols? Well, why did that happen? You know, was there time pressure? Was it ego? I don't need this. You know, I remember how to put my gear together. So accident analysis has informed a lot of that in my development. And those are hard lessons.
So it's not just what we've done wrong. It's why we did it wrong.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can look at an autopsy report on a diver and the cause of death is drowning. But Yeah, you can't breathe water. Well, that's obvious. But what caused them to breathe water, to try and breathe water? Was it a decision that they made before they got in the water? We've discovered that about 90% of the accidents are indeed a decision, a choice made before they got in the water. So it was entirely preventable. So it's really looking at more of the root causes, like why, you know, what happened? Why did it happen? How can we prevent this next time?
In the different teams where you've gone about producing such a charter, do you often get different charters or do they all mostly end up being pretty well the same?
I would say they mostly end up being the same, but I've definitely noticed quite a difference in if the project has men and women or just women in a team. So the women's charters are always longer. And a little bit.
Is that right?
A little.
Why? Right. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. Let's go. So that's the fact. Yeah. That's the thing behind it.
Women are actually more excited about going through this whole exercise. Like if you say, we're going to have a day of team building before we actually start this project, most men's eyes will glaze over. And they're like, oh, really? All this woo-hoo shit. But women are kind of more excited. Oh, yes, please. You know, let's figure this out. Let's have this on paper. You know, this is going to help me. This is going to help the team. So, yeah, it's interesting.
And there's never a difference because of generations or geography or cultures?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the end result of the charter is almost always the same, but getting there is incredibly powerful. Like I remember one project where we were each asked to write on post-it notes, fears and hopes for the expedition. Put the hopes on this panel, put the fears on that panel. And people were writing things like, oh, I fear this television production becoming like a reality TV show instead of true, you know, documentary style or whatever. Oh, I fear that I'm not going to get a chance to see a beluga whale, you know, the dream that I've always had in my life. So there were all these sort of, you know, things that I didn't think were terribly important. And I wrote on the piece of paper, I'm scared that one of you is going to die because you don't understand what you're about to embark upon. And I stuck that on the wall. And everyone kind of went, whoa, what? Whoa. And they said, please explain. And I went up to the board and I started to cry. I said, you know, I appreciate that these are things that are weighing heavy on your mind, but I couldn't sleep last night because I know that we're about to do something that many of you don't have experience in. And I don't think you even know what could kill you at this moment. And I just feel this sick feeling in this, you know, in the center of my body that just doesn't seem to want to go away. Like, we've got to solve this. I can't feel this anxiety because I already really like everybody in this room and I want you all to come home safely and we have wonderful memories from this project. So my fear is that one of you are going to die. And, you know, it casts a bit of a pall over the room, but it also kind of snaps people into reality like, oh, I was just coming for this exciting vacation kind of an experience. You say there's a chance I could die? And it's like, yeah, there is. So let's make sure that doesn't happen.
I suppose my last question is about success. I think you said to me, success is an overemphasized concept.
You know, it's interesting. I was just at a conference last week and someone was giving a talk about successful deep world record dives. And so they had a flow chart or an Excel spreadsheet of successful and unsuccessful deep record dives. And yeah,
which they produced, no doubt.
yeah. But a physician in the room, you know, rightly so, my hand was right up behind him. It's like, so you define success as surviving and unsuccessful as someone that dies on that diving record attempt. And he's like, yes. And it's like, but in order for you to have reached this world record status, you've had lots of unsuccessful dives. Those are what we all need to learn from. You know, we need to learn about the times that you made a mistake or that something happened. Like, it's not just successful because you survived it. And so I get a little bristled by that whole concept, because I like failure. And I think that we're incredibly hard on ourselves and say, oh, we failed in our mission. It's like, did we? We brought everybody home back alive. I thought that was the successful measure. So when things go wrong, well, that's when we have the opportunity to learn the most. And so I like to look at failure as something I call discovery learning. And it just allows you to take away the stigma and say, all right, this is the next step towards success. It's not failure. I mean, the light bulb didn't happen on the first iteration. There were, you know, modular steps towards success, not 100 failures. So I like to take away the weight of some of those words. And I think that makes it a little easier for everybody.
Thank you so, so much, Jill. That was wonderful. It picks up this expression that we often use with the four E's of reframing, because you reframe fear as a friend. You reframe the most junior people as the most crucial people. You reframe those people who ask a string of irritating questions as people worthy of all the answers, worthy of the time to give all those answers. And you reframe failure as discovery learning. I've loved this episode. I won't forget that expression, never follow a fearless leader, because they don't fully respect the risks and therefore don't mitigate against them. That's, over the years with this podcast, some little words have managed to make it onto my pin board, and those are big and strong and extraordinary. So a great episode. Thank you so, so much, Jill. I think I will never follow Jill down a cave, but I am absolutely clear that I am going to follow Jill's advice on leading. So thank you. Next week, other insights into leading in hostile environments. In the meantime, I send you all my love, Julia. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to follow our podcast channel or follow us on Instagram, or join the Women Emerging community on LinkedIn or through our website, womenemerging.org. That's womenemerging.org. There you can find out about the expeditions that we're currently running and how we can help if you decide to start an expedition yourself.